Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that we got going on over there. While you're over at 1517, you can go to the events page. You can slide on down to city events. We're going to be in Houston in February, February 22nd. We're going to be in Las Vegas in March, March 21st. Chad and I will be at that Houston event, along with Scott Keith, Loso, Gretchen Ronovic, Matt Popovitz. We'd love to have you come out. It's free. You can just register. So registration is open. We need you to register so we know how many people to expect, because, you know, lunch, refreshments, all that sort of stuff. So hop over there, put your name and email in there so we know you're coming, and then just show up, and we're going to spend the whole day together. Also, you know, if you're in the Las Vegas area, do the same thing. Eric Sorensen will be there. I'll be there. Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, Cindy Koch, Blake Flatley. We're going to be going through the book of Galatians, the whole thing in one day. Six speakers, six chapters. We're going to be doing that, and we'd love to see you there. So register for free. It's all over there at the events page at 1517.org. Also, in the show notes, if you're interested in this, all you international listeners, all you people there over there in Europe, I will put a link in the show notes. Scroll on down on your app, or if you're listening on the internet, scroll down the page. You will see the Great Freedom Conference in Hamburg, Germany. That registration is now open. So if you are in Germany or in Europe somewhere where you can get to Germany, we would love to see you there. Chad will be there. Eric will be there. Scott Keith, myself, we're going to be talking about Christian freedom. And, you know, we're excited because it's in Europe. But if you're in Europe, you should be excited because we're coming to Europe. Either way, you're gonna experience something that you wouldn't experience otherwise. The glory that is for Americans. It's gonna be amazing. We're gonna experience, you know, a whole new country. A little bit better deal for us than you, but still, you're getting something. So you can go over there and register. The link is in the show notes. Chad, how's it going, man?
It's going good. Yeah, we're enjoying down here in South Texas a little relief from our typical 100 degree weather. So we're chilling. We actually got down in the 30s in Texas. Crazy stuff.
I just realized I should have said three Americans, one Texan.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to correct you, but I decided to be charitable enough.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah, we're all good down here. We're just kind of, you know, we're drifting into fall, and, you know, November, December, just always, the whole year goes by fast. Of course, the older you get, but man, November, December, just like a blur every year. You got parents coming in, you're going to visit people, you got the festive times of the season. So yeah, it's we're gonna turn around and be 2020 before we know it.
Yeah, man, fall is my favorite. It's my favorite time of year. It's where, yeah, the weather is just perfect for me, because it's not, I don't like it too cold, I don't like that nonsense, but the fall is just right. Not too hot, not too cold. You got the holidays in there, man, so you know, it's always good food, you know, in the fall. And for me, when I say fall too, I mean, I know most people, December is winter, but even in Arkansas, like it can get cold. I mean, it's snowed on Christmas before and stuff, but for the most part, it's January and February that are really cold. We're farther enough south that that's the case. So for me, when I think of fall, I kind of think, because also, likewise, September is still summer as far as I'm concerned, because it's still pretty hot in September in the south.
Yeah.
So I think of fall, I think October, November, December.
Yeah.
End,
yeah,
of the year.
Yeah, same here. Right, yeah. Well, I work outside, so it's like perfect working weather. So I'll show up to work with a light jacket on, take it off late morning or by lunch. It's just perfect. So
yeah,
that's great.
I'm sure people are riveted by the weather that we have in the south, but they're probably tuned in for us to get
just to hear about that.
Yeah, they might have tuned in to hear about what's going on with the people of Israel and the book of Joshua.
Yeah, you know, we got a chapter coming up here that's like, it's like part comedy, as are a lot of the other parts of scripture. I mean, this is kind of a crazy story. The Gibeonites, they dressed up like they were from, you know, some distant country, and had all this mildew, moldy bread in their saddlebags. So they pretend like they're from some way, way distant country. So and the ruse works. So anyway, it's kind of an interesting chapter to talk about, not just the narrative, but actually there's some theological stuff in here too about how do you deal with sort of, you got two commands from God, and which are in seeming contradiction. So how do you deal with that? So anyway, we got some good stuff to get to, but I mentioned at the end of the last episode that we were going to spend a few minutes finishing up chapter 8. So we want to do that first. So this is on the chapter 8 is on the heels of the defeat of the city of Ai, the city that had first defeated the Israelites, and then the Israelites turned around and defeated them. So after this, the Israelites travel north and they fulfill what God had told them to do when Moses was still around. This is in Deuteronomy chapter 27, when God tells them to, when you enter the Holy Land, I want you to go up there by these two mountains, by the city of Shechem, and build an altar there and offer some sacrifices, and then write the law of Moses, the Torah, on some stones. And then you're supposed to read kind of half and half the blessings and the curses. So that's what's going on here at the end of chapter 8. Let me read just those last three or four verses of chapter 8, beginning with verse 32. And Joshua wrote there on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written in the presence of the sons of Israel. And all Israel, with their elders and officers and their judges, were standing on both sides of the ark before the Levitical priest who carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord, the stranger as well as the native. Half of them stood in front of Mount Gerizim, and half of them stood in front of Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had given command at first to bless the people of Israel. Then afterward, he read all the words of the law, the blessings and the curse, according to all that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded, which Joshua did not read before the assembly of Israel, with the women and the little ones and the strangers who were living among them. So you got two or three things going on here. You first of all had the construction of the altar itself, which we talked about at the end of last episode. Excuse me. Then you had the law of Moses, and we're not sure how much. I mean, was this all of Deuteronomy? Was this kind of selected portions? We're really not told. All we're told is it was the law of Moses, or the book of the law of Moses, that was written on these stones. And then Joshua read it all to them. And he didn't just read it to like the leadership or to the men, but everybody. In fact, to the strangers, as it says there in verse 33. That is those who were non-Israelites who, for one reason or another, had joined up with the Israelites. So they weren't physically descendants of Abraham. They were Gentiles, as we would call them, but they had joined the people of Israel. And we have lots of references to these through the Torah, as those of you who are long-term listeners know. Constantly, God tells the Israelites through Moses to take care of the orphan, the widow, and the alien, or the stranger, the sojourner, so one who's not an Israelite, but who's living among the people of Israel. So it's kind of interesting, isn't it, that it's not just God's words through Moses to the people of Israel isn't just for Israel. It's for all of those who are living here in the Holy Land. So he reads this, and then we have this kind of antiphonal response back and forth with the blessings and the curses between these two mountains. Everything was read. Nothing was left out. Everything that Moses had commanded was read there by Joshua. Now, what's interesting geographically about what's happening here in these last few verses of Joshua 8 is that it takes place very near to the city of Shechem. Now, as we've said many times in the Old Testament, theology is deeply embedded in geography. So there's hardly anything that's just geographical about the Old Testament, because place names and mountains and the characteristics of certain regions, it's more than just a description of what it looks like or the landscape. There's always some sort, almost always, some sort of theological meaning or metaphor that's attached. Now, Shechem is a great example of this. Shechem wasn't just a dot on the Israelite map. If you go all the way back to the beginning of Abraham's narrative, which is Genesis chapter 12. So Abraham, of course, leaves his country, leaves his family, leaves his father's household to go to the land that God is going to show to him. He's 75 years old. Sarah, who's called Sarai at that point, is 10 years younger. And Lot, of course, Abraham's nephew, is along for the ride. So they leave, and they pass through the land. And verse 6 of Genesis 12, it says, Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem, to the oak of Mamre, to the oak of Moreh, excuse me. And then it says that God appeared to him in verse 7 and says, to you and to your descendants I will give this land. And notice this, Abram built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. So as soon as Abram gets in the land of promise, God appears to him and he builds an altar and he hears God's promises there at Shechem. Now, fast forward a lot of generations, and now we have Abraham's descendants, the people of Israel, and they have now entered into the land of promise after all these years. And what happens? Well, they go right there near the city of Shechem, and they build an altar, and they hear the promises of God, and they offer sacrifices. So, in other words, things have come full circle. You can draw a line from Genesis chapter 12 to Joshua chapter 8 as a demonstration of God's fidelity to keep his promises and the people's response in hearing the word and believing the promises in worshiping by building the altar and offering sacrifice. So it's pretty cool how you can see this fulfillment of what began back in Genesis 12 in that very spot where Abram had built his first altar.
Yeah, that is.
And
cool.
I think that's all I got. Want to add anything about those verses?
Not only if it was indeed the entire book of the law, that's a lot to write on those. I mean, that's a long sermon. It's a lot of writing on rocks.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to, if they were like chiseling these in, I wouldn't want that job.
Yeah. No. Even if it's just a good sized portion of it, man. When you think about writing, when it says like writing things on stones, it doesn't mean that they didn't whip out a quill. The idea, when God, and God will say this in the prophets, especially the minor prophets, he'll say like, hey, write this on stone. And mm-hmm. what he means is that carve it into stone so that it's very difficult to make go away. Right? There's a permanence in the instruction, right?
Right, right. Yeah, there's kind of a Sinai flavor to all this, too. You've got Mount Sinai. Well, here you have two mountains. Of course, at Mount Sinai, you had the law inscribed on the tablets of stone. And here you have probably more than just that, but the words of God inscribed on stone. You have an altar at Sinai. You have an altar here. You have sacrifices at Sinai, sacrifices here. So a sort of, a threefold connection between Genesis 12 and Abraham, and Exodus 20 with Moses and the Israelites, and now here in Joshua 8 with Joshua and the Israelites.
Yeah.
All right. So that's chapter 8. Moving on. So all of chapter 9, and actually part of chapter 10, is about these people from the city of Gibeon. And most of the narrative is just in chapter 9, at least. Kind of it's a complete story, and we'll kind of hear the next chapter of that story, what follows in Joshua chapter 10. The first two verses, you kind of put a parenthesis around them, because it's sort of in literary terms, we would call this foreshadowing, because it kind of sets the stage for what's going to happen later, but it really doesn't expand on it at this point. So the first two verses give us a broad summary of the reaction of most of the Canaanites to what had happened so far with Israel. It says, now it came about when all the kings who were beyond the Jordan, that is on the west side of the Jordan, so not the east side, but in the hill country and in the lowland and all the coast of the Great Sea toward Lebanon, and then we have a list of these people, the Hittite and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite. When all these people groups heard of it, what'd they do? Well, verse 2 says, they gathered themselves together with one accord, literally with one mouth, kind of a Hebrew idiom for what we would say is like unanimously, I guess. So they gathered together unanimously with one accord to fight with Joshua and with Israel. So, and that's all that's really said about those particular groups at this point, because verse 3 picks up with the story of Gibeon. Now, a couple of things to point out. This is back to kind of the geography that I mentioned earlier. If you're familiar with the overall land features of Israel, there's three main areas. And it just so happens that all three of these areas are mentioned in the opening verse of chapter 9. It says that all the kings who are beyond the Jordan in three different places. First of all, in the hill country. Secondly, in the lowland, at least that's the way my translation has it. And then on the coast. Those are the three main areas of Israel. So on the eastern side of Israel is where you have the hill country. That's where you have the mountainous region. That's where you have Jerusalem, for instance. So you have mountains in that area. And then it starts to slope down toward the Mediterranean Sea. And what you encounter in this kind of sloping land with low hills is what's usually referred to as the Shephelah. Here it's translated lowland. But it's kind of this gradually decreasing area, decreasing in altitude, working its way toward the coast. And then you get to the coast. And that is the third main area along the Great Sea, which is the biblical term for the Mediterranean. So you get hill country, you get the Shephelah, and then you have the coastland. So these three areas of Israel were occupied by all these various people groups. And these were mostly, you know, I guess they're called city-states for the most part. So you have maybe a main city with some satellite cities around it. And most of these would have had a king and were connected with the various smaller cities who were around them. And it's the same with Gibeon, as we're going to hear in just a minute. So all these various people groups had their cities, had their areas. And for the most part, I'm assuming they just, you know, either they were at peace or maybe they were warring with each other on occasion. But now they've got a common enemy, the people of Israel. And what Israel has done in Egypt and then to Og and to Jericho and to Ai, I mean, word of this is spreading. We've already seen in the case of Jericho that the rumors of Israel's power had spread to the people of Jericho. Well, these other people are, of course, are hearing about these strange newcomers to the land who have this mighty God on their side, and they're just demolishing everybody in their path. So, you know, they decide they're going to be prudent, and they're going to band themselves together against the common enemy, and they're going to fight against him. And we'll hear more about that once we get past the rest of the chapter, but that kind of sets the stage for what's going to be coming next. So let's see what happens. Picking up here with verse 3. Six different people groups, all these Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, so on and so forth. But verse 3 says there was one particular place, and as we'll hear later in the chapter, it actually was four different cities. There was one particular place, or at least one particular people, who decided wisely, as we shall see, who decided they were going to go about this in a very different sort of way. So these are the people of the city of Gibeon. Now, Gibeon is about, I think it's about 6 miles northwest of Jerusalem. So if you kind of picture in your mind the map of Israel, that's where they're at. So about 6 miles or so northwest of Jerusalem. And it's a city that actually has been located by archaeologists. They've done a lot of digging there. Back in the mid 1900s, there were some pretty major archaeological digs there, and they found all sorts of evidence that this actually, the site they were digging was actually the biblical city of Gibeon. I mean, they found, I think, around 30 jars, mostly wine jars, that had the, in old Hebrew script, the word Gibeon written on them. So they have not only just kind of the pottery evidence, but actually have inscriptional evidence that this was the city of Gibeon. And you may have heard of the pool that's associated with this place. It was dug into the rock. Go to Google and search for an image of the pool of Gibeon. And it's got like, because it has like 70 steps or 74 steps that are carved in the rock and that they're leading down to this pool, that which was the way that the city got its water. So anyway, that's the city. Big city, powerful city, but a city that decides that it's going to try and make peace with the Israelites. But the way they go about this is very creative and actually very comedic at the same time. So they, verse 3 says, the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai. So what'd they do? Verse 4 says, they acted craftily. That word, the Hebrew word for craftily, is related to the Hebrew word that is used all the way back in Genesis chapter 3, verse 1 to describe how the serpent was more crafty or subtle. So the Hebrew word arum for crafty is related to this particular word that's used here in Joshua chapter 9. So they're going to act deceitfully or with cunning or craftily.
You have to think that these people, they hear that, they look at Jericho, they look at Ai, and they're like, we got to figure out a way to not have that repeated over here. Yeah. And maybe they're thinking,
things are not looking good for us.
No, and they might be thinking, we might have to come up with like a plan that's better than just saying, hey, can we be friends? Because like these people are just straight running over people. I mean, you have to assume that the Gibeonites are thinking, I think they're just going to take over everything. So what's the strategy here? Like, we need a better strategy than just like we don't want any trouble. They don't want to just wave a white flag and be like, you can have our city, just don't kill us all. They obviously don't want to go that route. So they want to do they want to come up with a plan that says, how can we live together? Because you would have to assume. I mean, this would be like if you just had this invading force and was taking out your neighbors, you'd be like, I don't know if they're going to just be down for just, live and let live.
Yeah. Yeah. The evidence would suggest no.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, as we'll hear, as the story progresses, they knew not only what the Israelites had done to those two cities, to Ai and to Jericho, but they also knew what had happened on the other side of the Jordan. They knew what Israel had done to Sihon and to Og. So, yeah, they were weighing the odds and decided, our best bet is going to be to make peace. But the evidence also suggests that there's no peace if we're actually living in the land that they're trying to take for themselves.
Right.
So we're going to have to pretend like we're not neighbors down the street. So we're going to have to pretend like we're from a long way off and we've come to make a covenant, a peace with you guys, just in case you happen to come into our territory someday. That way, we'll have a covenant. Everything will be good between us. So you can kind of picture all the leaders, like they're sitting around late at night, throwing around various ideas. And one guy's like, I've got an idea. I know what we can do. Let's dig in like the very back of our closets and like get the worst shoes we have. And let's go out to the barn. Let's find some old saddlebags and let's get that, that bread we forgot we had in the, back in the cupboard. It's got all mold on it now. Let's get the worst of our food and the worst of our traveling gear, worst of our clothing, get all this together and then go see the Israelites. I think this is going to work. Well, so that's what they do. So they get these worn out sacks and bring these donkeys. Doesn't say like they got like their worst donkeys, but maybe they got the donkeys that are kind of old. Yeah, the ribs are showing a little bit. They get the wineskins that are worn and patched up and worn out patched sandals on their feet. it's quite an image you have of these guys. And verse 5 says their bread was dry and crumbled. There's a possible you could translate that instead of crumbled as moldy. So even their bread is like moldy. And they go to Joshua and they're camped at Gilgal at this time. And verse 6 says, when they get there, they say, we have come from a far country. Now therefore make a covenant with us. And you can tell by the response of Joshua and the Israelites that they're not completely sure about this. Verse 7 says, perhaps you're living within our land or among us. How then shall we make a covenant with you? And they say to Joshua, we are your servants. Joshua, he's still not satisfied. He says, well, who are you? And where'd you come from? And verse 9 says, your servants have come from a very far country because of the name of the Lord your God. For we've heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. So our elders, this is them contending their speech. So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us saying, take provisions in your hand for your journey and go to meet them and say to them, we are your servants now, then make a covenant with us. And then you can kind of picture them like pulling out their saddlebags and showing the bread. Because verse 12, it says, this our bread was warm when we took it for our provisions out of our houses on the day that we left to come to you. But look, now it's dry and it's become crumbled or molded. These wineskins, which we feel were new, and behold, they are torn, and our clothes and our sandals are worn out because of the very long journey. So they make a pretty good case. You know, they could probably tell that Joshua and the rest of the Israelites are a little bit leery about this. They're not sure if this is actually true or not. So they're going to produce the evidence that they came from, that they came from a very, very distant country.
This plan only works in a time before maps.
Yeah, you notice they never said exactly where they're from. I mean, far away is a relative term, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we come from like a long way off. Long way off.
Yeah, I mean, because it's very difficult to put yourself in this position where they are traveling, the Israelites are traveling, they don't know what other cities there are, where they are. Like, they don't know. They've not been here.
Right.
You know? I mean, it's like when you landed in America and you decided to start going west. You don't know what's out. Like, you have no idea what's out there. So someone comes up to you like, oh, we came from a long way off. Like, you have no idea what is 10 miles in the direction that you've not gone yet. You don't know what's over there.
Yeah, it's not like Joshua's going to pull out his iPhone. Like, yeah, actually, yeah, like, all right, show me on the GPS exactly where you're located.
But you also are like, is this plan really going to work? Because you are also like, you're not coming from very far. And eventually, this is also something that's interesting, because the only way for this plan to work is if you believe that this people will keep a covenant that they make no matter what, even if they were tricked into it. Because there's no way that this group of people believe that at some point in the future, they're not going to figure out that these people are their neighbors.
Yeah. And as it turns out, that happens real fast.
Yeah. And so, I mean, what they're doing is saying, like, make the promise and then you're in. Like, sign the contract.
Yeah.
And then you can be mad and say that we deceived you and tricked you, but, you know, we got your word. So now you have to stick by it.
Right. Well, and that kind of brings us to one of the points that I wanted to make, too, about this chapter. So, well, first of all, what happens? Well, you know, that's exactly what does happen. It says the Israelites, they looked at their provisions, and significantly, I think, I've got this highlighted in my Bible, verse 14, they did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. So they, like, you know, they didn't consult the Urim and Thummim or whatever it might be. They didn't consult God. They just kind of went by the evidence, made a decision based on that. So Joshua, what happens? Well, Joshua, it says, made peace with them, and they made a covenant to let them live, and they swore this oath. So the Gibeonites got what they wanted. Well, as you said, there's only so long they're going to be able to pull this off before Israel finds out. And it only takes like 3 days. Verse 16 says, it came about the end of 3 days after they'd made the covenant that they heard, we don't know how, but they heard that they were actually neighbors and that they were living in their land. So the Israelites take a trip. They go to these particular cities. And it's here in verse 17 that we find out it wasn't just one city, but there were four cities, Gibeon and Sherethah and Be'erot and Kiriath Yarim. So four different cities, all the same people group. And it says the Israelites didn't like attack because they had sworn that they wouldn't. But not everybody's happy about this, because we have a recurrence of a verb, a Hebrew verb that we have encountered very frequently in the Torah. The verb for grumble, because the end of verse 18, the Israelites were evidently not very happy with Joshua and with all those who decided to make a covenant, because they grumbled against the leaders. They didn't like this situation. But the leaders say, listen, we swore an oath by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we can't touch them, because if we do, God's wrath is going to come upon us. So they come up with a different plan. They decide that they're going to let them live, but they're going to make them into hewers of wood and drawers of water. So they're going to make them basically the servants of the people of Israel. Let me go ahead and finish the story out, and we'll go back and talk about these details. So verse 22 says that Joshua came out, and first of all, he's not very happy. He says, why have you deceived us by saying, you know, you live a long way from us when you're living right next door? So he says, now therefore you're cursed, and you shall never cease being slaves, hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of the Lord my God. Another significant point we'll come back to in a minute. Well, then they answer. They said, well, listen, verse 24, because here's why we did this, because we found out, we were told that the Lord your God had commanded Moses. This is amazing. They even know who Moses is. We found out that God, your God, had commanded Moses to give you all the land and to wipe out all the inhabitants of the land before you. So it's like these guys know the Torah. They know what God had commanded Moses. So they knew that if they didn't do something, living in the land, they were gonna die. And we were greatly afraid, it says. And so that's why we did this. And you know, these people in Gibeon are smart, because verse 25 says, this is how they end it. They say, now, look, we are in your hands. Do as it seems good and right in your sight to do to us. Now, the reason I say they're smart is because that those two words, good and right, are Torah words, and they occur repeatedly in the Torah as a description of how Israel should act. So the Gibeonites are basically saying, they're not just saying, oh, do whatever you want with us. They're basically, by using this language, they're saying, do whatever you deem right according to God's word.
Right. Yeah. According to the Torah. They're basically saying, like, if you think that your God is cool with lying and that there will be no consequences for that, well, then, you know, do what you got to do. But
do what you got to do. Yeah.
And Israel is in a bind here because, I mean, they did make a covenant. And I don't know if you know, but God is kind of like serious about such things.
Mm-hmm.
You have to assume that the Gibeonites must have done some reconnaissance on this, on these whole people of Israel thing.
Yeah, they did some pretty good research, didn't they? Yeah, I mean, they found out their history. They found out even what God had commanded them through Moses. I mean, that's the part that just amazes me. They like know Deuteronomy. They know that God told Moses to tell the people of Israel to wipe out all the inhabitants of the land. How do they know that? Well, I don't know, but they found it out somehow.
And if somehow they know that this God is not not down with lying.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, they're kind of in a, not the Gibeonites, but the Israelites, I mean, they're sort of in a dilemma, because on the one hand, God did clearly tell them to wipe out all the cities that are within the boundaries of the Holy Land. And he told them that very clearly. Now, he did tell them back in Deuteronomy 20, I think, that if there's a city outside the promised land that wants to make peace with you, well, fine. You can do that. You can make a treaty with cities that are east of the Jordan or maybe north of the boundaries of your tribes, whatever, as long as they're outside the land, you can do that. But everybody in the land has to be destroyed. So you've got, on one hand, that command, but then you also have the Israelites' promise. They have the oath. They have the covenant that they made. So they're kind of stuck. You know, what are you going to do? Are you going to basically live by the letter of the law with regard to destruction and judgment? Or are you going to live by the promise of life itself that you've given to these people that you've made this treaty with? So what are you going to do?
Well, I guess all you can do is that when they come forward and say, we are your servants, say, well, that's what you said.
That's what you said. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great example of kind of a conundrum that the people of Israel found themselves in. What are they going to live by? Well, they lived by, in some sense, mercy, because they decided to spare these people because they had promised to do that. And as we're going to find out in the next chapter, not only did they promise to basically be at peace with them, but they even come to their rescue. Because as we'll find out in the next episode, in chapter 10, there's a whole bunch of these other peoples that come and attack Gibeon when they found out what they did. And Israel comes to their rescue. So this is a serious treaty. This isn't just kind of a live and let live. Another thing that's fascinating about this to me is that is they didn't just make them like the basest of slaves or the basest, most menial of servants. They actually, in a very ironic sort of way, they brought them within the kind of the closest parameter of the holy life of the Israelites, because they didn't make them like hewers of wood and drawers of water for Israelite cities or for rich Israelite families that could afford to have all these servants. They actually made them servants of the tabernacle. And then later, of course, of the temple, because it says verse 23 and then verse 27, Joshua says, you're going to be hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. And then verse 27, it says, Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord to this day at the place which he would choose. So pretty fascinating that these people who could have been destroyed actually were spared. They were made servants, yes, but they were made servants going to be serving at the very altar and at the very tabernacle and later the temple of God. So they were going to be actually drawn into the worship of the people of Israel, which I find to be pretty fascinating. And if you're going to be, you know, if you can end up being servants, well, then being a servant in the house of God is not a bad place to be.
Well, in part, sort of what's implied by, you know, cutters of wood and drawers of water is that when he says he makes them this, what he means is that they are not, he's not going to allow them to be people of war. Like, he's not going to allow them to be people that assemble an army or accumulate military strength, because this would obviously be a danger. He's not going to sit by and watch them, you know, accumulate this army that then can turn. So he's like, you're not going to do that, which is probably part of the reason why Israel will have to go to their aid, because he has given them vocations that do not include having some robust military.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think, too, that part of the reason that he gave them these specific jobs is actually related to what they were accustomed to doing. Because, you know, I mentioned there were four cities that are connected with the city of Gibeon. And a couple of those actually have to do with wood and water. So that one of these is called Kiriath Yearim, which is the Hebrew for a town of woods. So evidently this particular city was maybe close to a forest or something like that. And that was, you know, reason it was called Kiriath Yearim, the city of wood or the town of woods, because it was close to that. So presumably they would have been familiar with dealing with lumber, cutting down trees and things like that. Another one of the cities is called Be'erot. So in Hebrew, Be'er, which looks just like the English word beer, that's a Hebrew word for a well. So you have two city names that are actually connected, one with water and one with wood. So maybe the particular task assigned to these guys actually was something they were familiar with.
Well, as you were saying, they have this awesome well there already. I mean, it's reasonable. They'd be like, see what we're going to have you guys do. That's a pretty sick water source. Like, obviously,
you know water, so let's have you do water.
Apparently, you know about drawing water out of that thing. We got something for you to do.
I got something for you to do. Yeah, and one more thing about this that we haven't really touched on, but I think it's significant. You know, we can talk about how this is sort of a comedy. You know, there's a lot of funny things about this particular story, but you have to appreciate the Gibeonites. Because whatever their other motives might have been, they were well aware that the people they were coming to had a God who could be trusted, who could be believed in, who was powerful, who was true. Because otherwise, why come? In fact, it says literally in verse 9, your servants have come from a far country to the name of the Lord your God. Now, my translation has because of the fame of the Lord your God, but the Hebrew literally says that your servants have come from a very far country to the name of the Lord your God. So they know where to go. They come to the name. They come to, and of course, as we've discussed lots of times, name is not just kind of a word, but a name captures the very essence of a thing. So they have come to this one this God that they know, that they've heard of, that is going to be the one that they can actually rely on, who is going to be a refuge and a protection for them. And they end up actually serving at the very tabernacle of this God to whom they come. So you gotta look at the Gibeonites. Yeah, they're kind of sneaky. They kind of do things underhanded. They're very cunning. But there's also another motivation. They come to a God that they know that they can trust, because he's proven that by his deeds with the people of Israel.
Well, he is the God, as we've mentioned before, that you actually can trap with his promises.
Mm-hmm.
And is willing to be trapped in his promises. Yeah. And this is what they do. And they trap God with the words of Israel, the promise of Israel. They quote their scriptures back to them. I mean, they do, in fact, basically corner God with being one who cannot lie. And this is an okay thing to do. God is willing to be trapped by his own words.
That's what they're doing here too.
Yeah, and that is it, man. That's 40 minutes. Guys, if you would like to support the podcast, if it's been helpful to you, you can do so by going over to 1517 and going on the donate page, and you can become a contributor. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. You make it possible for us to continue. Chad, I'll see you next week for Chapter 10.
I'll be here. See you then.